Well, good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable, and we appreciate you being with us on this Thursday morning. We have a new month, friends. It's the 1st of March. We are 3 months in, and time's just flying by, isn't it?
How did that happen?
I know. It's great to have you with us this morning. We have a terrific panel for you, and let me introduce them to you. A reminder, you can be a part of our program by simply writing to us, panel@wamc.org. We are got some different faces this morning. We're thrilled. Mike Spain is with us on Thursday, which is great. Mike Spain is the associate editor of the Times Union. Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm great. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. Teresa Bourgeois is here. She is a communications consultant, was with us yesterday, with us today. We're thrilled to have her back. Thank you.
So glad to be here.
Ira Fussfeld is back. He was away for a little while out on the West Coast visiting family and is back. Do you have any reports?
None that I can use on the air, but I just was very concerned that there's nothing been going on in the month or so since I've been here, and you've probably had nothing to talk about, so hopefully I'll inject something today.
Do you know what? I was picking stories last night for us to talk about, and there's so much that sort of rises to the top that it was when I shut my computer down going, oh my God, I don't even think I got to the Mike Pence abortion story. Good God. Well, welcome back. It's nice to have you here. Speaking of world travelers, Vera Akarias-Kelly is here. She is a professor of comparative politics at Siena College in Loudonville, New York, my father's alma mater. So very, very special place in our family. You just got back from Guatemala.
I sure did. It was a beautiful visit. I went with a student of mine from the political science and Spanish departments, along with Ann Kelly from Mayan Hands here in Albany. And we're carrying out an assessment survey with women, Maya women artisans in sort of the rural, more remote areas of Guatemala. So it was a wonderful visit. We got back with a lot of information, and now we're looking to evaluate all the results.
Is there an ultimate goal?
Yes, we're trying to figure out whether the Fair Trade Organization has dramatically improved the lives of women. So some groups that Mayan Hands works with has been in touch with this, you know, particular groups of artisans for over 20 years, 24 years, and some groups are newer, 2 or 3 years. So we're trying to see how much progress women have made in terms of the economic and educational status.
Go ahead, Ray.
No, I was going to say this makes my trip to Los Angeles look like going across the street.
Yeah. Hers is a little bit more.
Yes, a little bit more.
Right.
So
it's okay.
Quite a bit more. The women, I mean, it was incredible to visit these communities.
Is there anything sort of anecdotal or anything that you notice that would say, oh, you can see where the situation these women have improved?
So the work of Mayan Hands is incredibly powerful. When you visit groups that have worked with Mayan Hands for decades, you see that the women report in the surveys that they have regularized incomes now, access to drinking water, their household status have improved, their children are in school, so we see tremendous progress. Now we just have to evaluate the results and see what the other connections are that we can make. But it really shows that a fair trade organization can assist in development projects.
Well, it's very important work. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for sharing with us. And are they up on all of the news of the Trump kingdom?
Oh, it was so nice to be away and not hear about Trump at all, except for when I asked a couple of drivers. They had, you know, snarky remarks to make. For example, one of the cab drivers said, oh, yes, Trump, he's a bit of a crazy man, but we're used to those corrupt officials. We have them a lot, but now you got one of your own. So I thought, oh, well, okay.
Yay, we've done it.
He's made America great again.
Yeah, it's very nice. Well, good morning, everyone. Again, we welcome you, and we have our great cast here, and of course, we welcome your comments. panel@wamc.org. As I said, there's a lot to talk about, and it's hard, like in a day like today, even where to begin. But let us start with the Hope Hicks. Hope Hicks is out, the Trump aide, to resign amid personal tumult and the Russia probe. On the face of this, the White House and Hope Hicks are saying, we just made a decision. It was time for me to move on, and I've had enough, and I want to go spend time with the family I don't have, and whatever. So,
don't you think those might be white lies, Joe?
A little white lies. But the day before, she had testified for almost 9 hours and came under a great deal of fire. There are reports that following that the president just eviscerated her for what she said and didn't say during that time. And then, but they're putting on a happy face of it. Whether that's true or not, we don't know for sure. We do know that she is leaving within the next several days. And we also know that she had a very large role in this campaign and presidency. When it all began, it was Corey Lewandowski, Hope Hicks, and Donald Trump. And and Hope Hicks was sort of she was voted off the island, the last survivor. I'm sure we'll talk about this, but one of the more striking elements of the story was in watching CNN last night that they put a screen of all of the officials within the administration who have left, and the pictures are so tiny. It looks like your kindergarten class photo of these tiny little pictures with just the screen taken over with all of these human beings who have left, some after only hours of service.
Here's what we know about Hope Hicks, and now I'm going to pause for 5 seconds of silence because I don't want to kill the radio time, but we know almost nothing about her, Hope Hicks. We've heard her voice less than we've heard Jared Kushner's voice. We, the public, have not been able to take the measure of this person. We really don't know what she does other than she's very close to the president and that she was very close to Ivanka pre-White House days. We can presume that she didn't do much of a job as communications director, because for the life of me, I can't figure out what this administration's communications policy is other than to call the media fake news. I don't have any idea whether she's qualified for that job in the traditional sense of it. But now she's gone, and I suspect most in the public will not realize she was there and will not realize she's gone.
She came into the position after Anthony Scaramucci left. She ultimately replaced him, who replaced Sean Spicer. My question
was another one in between.
There was another one in between. Yeah. And what was her title prior to that when she originally – was just senior advisor? Was that the title?
Suspicious. Yeah,
assistant or something.
Right.
Yeah.
She had an office right outside of Trump's office and has been at his side. And they said that, you know, she's been the one who keeps him calm, you know, that hands him all his papers. It's just always with him.
She would tweet for him.
She's one, yeah. You know, she and Dan Scavino could tweet for him. Her background, 29 years old, worked as a model and then got into public relations and fashion. And she went to work for Ivanka Trump. And when the campaign was first beginning, she came into the campaign just because they needed somebody to do some PR. She had came to the job with absolutely no political background or experience at all.
But she you're right, Teresa, and I think she also played a role of sort of protecting some of the staff from the wrath of Trump. She was a sort of a conduit between,
insulation,
you know, right. Yeah, in that sense, sort of communicating what the president wants with and guarding the president in a sense that she would maintain communication to the staff.
Isn't that the chief of staff's job?
Well, this chief of staff had trouble with her because she didn't fit his hierarchy and order, but then I think he sort of respected her work with controlling Trump a little more than what other people had managed to do.
Now, let us talk about the two things. First of all, there's the testimony that she gave on Tuesday, but also there was the meeting in the plane, right? So she was centerpiece, not to mention her relationship with
Porter,
who
Rob that,
Porter.
Lewandowski.
So that also is in the question.
Married Lewandowski.
I'm sorry?
prior to that, her relationship with Lewandowski, who was married.
He was married. Yeah.
She had a relationship with him too.
Doesn't seem to have a good sort of handle on who to date. Is that a bad thing to say? I mean, she makes some poor choices. Lewandowski was also violent. I remember his sort of behavior towards he pushed a reporter
in Florida at a Trump rally, and there was an investigation where they're going to charge him with battery.
Right.
And it wasn't long after that he left the campaign.
Yeah.
But to Joe's point, she was always in the room, and most importantly, she was on the plane coming back from Europe when they reportedly drafted the statement about the meeting with the Russians and Don Jr.
in Trump Tower.
Right. And reportedly said that they didn't have to worry about the emails that Donald Trump Jr. wrote because, quote unquote, they'll never get out. And because of that, the other press person that was on the plane, who was the press person on behalf of the, you know, dealing with their legal issues, he left right after that. Because he said to her then, and then contemporaneously went and wisely told three other people so that there would be a contemporaneous account of it, what happened on the plane, and the fact that he said that that wasn't right, because in fact it appears to be obstruction of justice.
Well, I'll go back to where I started.
She's right in the middle of everything.
But she just seems to me to have been entirely unqualified for that job in the traditional sense of that job. If you're saying to me, and I've heard it mentioned last night, that she was somebody who maybe has put a monitor on Trump so that he wouldn't completely go nuts, and served a role subsequently that was being held by his body man, Keith Schiller, who also is no longer there, which begs the question, what's going to happen now if he doesn't have these people by his side? But I think the broader question beyond Hope Hicks is Donald Trump's administration. He was going to hire the best people. He has not built a large team. Many of the people who he hired are no longer with him. It just seems from the outside, and I could be wrong, I've been wrong once or twice, this is an administration that is entirely in disarray, and Hicks's departure is just another brick on the load.
Well, Alan isn't here, so let me be the one to say I disagree with you. I don't think you've ever been wrong.
well, then there was one instance, right?
But in an administration where everything is about him, this is the lead story, and it was a lead story on the.
I'm not saying it's unimportant, but I think she's less important than the broader story.
But I think the lead story for the country, if you're focusing on the country as opposed to him, if you're focusing on him because of what you said about Keith Schuller, because they're so close, but I think that the issue with between the president and the attorney general, if you're talking about the country, I think the. I think that what Putin said today on raising the stakes on nuclear weapons is the bigger story for our country right now. I think the fact that we're 4 days away from the DACA expiring, and I know there's a court case that's holding that, or the budget things. There's so many other stories that really for the country are most important. And there's this horrific story in the Military Times about them deep. Trying to deport the wife of a special forces officer, and there's so many deportations going on. Those are what matter to the American people, not to mention the gun story. But unfortunately, because this administration is so much about Donald Trump.
You make a good point, but if Hope Hicks was one of the few people that could calm Donald Trump down, and she's gone, and the other aide is gone, this could be big trouble. And it could mean an eruption of tempers that may just stop any action on anything.
Not to mention Kushner.
But can't,
yeah. Right.
Right. We'll get to Kushner because that's obviously a huge part of the story. But can't we just – I mean, isn't it fair to say that no matter what names we put into the – If you think of it as a placeholder of whatever plaque you – of name plaque or name card that you slide into that it's going to be chaos, right? I mean, that's what this White House is. I mean, it's a style. It's his style, and it's what's going to happen regardless of who the players are.
And he's his own communications director. I mean, that's the fundamental issue here. He's his own communications director.
And now he will likely have access. I mean, Hope Hicks apparently restrained Trump's access to various media sites and fed him. I mean, her job was to print out certain stories and give the printed copies to President Trump.
She was his filter.
In essence, that is correct. And now with the filter gone, I think it's likely Joe will have mayhem breaking out.
More so than what
more
we
so
already
than
how
what
will
we're
they
already
know
used
the difference?
To.
Yeah, how will they know that?
Well, you know, that is a good point, because mayhem is what apparently dominates this White House. So now we'll really have access some exciting developments.
We have less than a minute, but one of the things that I heard last night as I was watching the various Fox and CNN and MSNBC was that, look, this is with all of these changes and with all of this going on, it seems that these are all stories that continually come out of the White House day after day after day after day after day. And no one that I heard last night that has been covering this beat for a short period of time, or in David Gergen's case, forever, look at this and say, none of this is normal, and that nothing is getting – it's all stories that are coming out of the White House that don't have to. And so we'll talk about some more of those stories after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Ira Fussfeld, Vera Carias-Kelly, Mike Spain here. Alan is off today, and we'll be off tomorrow as well, but we'll be back on Monday. We have some letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Keith says, stating the obvious, Hope Hicks also makes bad decisions in who she works for. Her bad decisions are not only limited to who she dates. Hicks now needs high-priced lawyers to defend her in the Mueller probe, all because she worked for a narcissistic pathological liar. Who could have predicted this? She will forever be known for working for Trump. She's typecasted as a lying Trump enabler.
Yep.
Well, some predict that she will go back after a bit of a rest and dealing with her legal woes. She'll go back and work on the 2020 campaign.
And that is because the president in his statement said, we look forward to working with
this
her
is,
again
she
in
just,
the future.
She just needs some rest. By all accounts, you know, Maggie Haberman said she truly is exhausted. People love her in the White House, and the reporters seem to be a bit protective of her in the way they're writing the stories. So
Robert writes, you know, I was thinking about that last night
of
Katie Turr's book, and that the relationship that she had with Hope Hicks is an interesting one, and that she came off as sort of a straight shooter in that, I thought.
Yeah, people seem to really, the people who work around her, media and the staff, seem to really admire her and think she's an important part of the process. And I remember when she was named communications director, there seemed to be a sense of relief and think that that was a great thing. So,
Robert says the White House said Hicks was planning for her departure for months. Since she was only in the role for 100 days, that would mean she started planning her departure as soon as she got the job. Yeah,
which
right.
is probably standard when you get an appointment in the Trump administration.
Right. Right. You immediately think of how you're going to get out of it.
How long will this last, and where will I go next?
Well, the thing is, staying there also just increases the potential that she's wittingly or unwittingly engaged in obstruction of justice. So, I mean, I think for her, her lawyers probably said,
It's time to go, yeah.
Carol says, so let me get this right. Trump introduced Hicks and lauded her as being someone who has no political experience and was anti-establishment and anti-swamp as a result. Now he's all PO'd at her for not knowing how to conduct herself for his protection in a nine-hour interrogation by experienced experts in the political arena. He's such a bully.
Correct.
Steven says, if she's a calming influence on stable genius, God help us now. Yes, Steve. We'll embroider that in a pillow, I think.
Amen.
Yeah. So, and then who comes next?
Well, is he going to succeed in bullying Sessions out? I mean, it looks like Sessions, to his credit, is digging in. He spoke up against Trump when Trump called him disgraceful yesterday in a tweet, and Sessions made a statement that he's doing his job and he's going to protect the Constitution, and then went out to dinner last night with Rosenstein and who was the third?
The
another
Solicitor General.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So a high-profile dinner. Yeah. And that seems to me to be sending a message to Trump as well. And I think Trump's either going to have to fire him because I don't think Sessions is going to quit.
Yeah, I don't think Sessions is going to quit either. But I also don't think Trump is going to fire him because Sessions is getting increasing support from
right.
his senatorial colleagues from, you know, he served, I think it was 20 years in the Senate. Yeah, I think Trump is boxed
and
he won't be getting rid of Sessions now.
He's had that support really from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. He was very well thought of within the Senate. So Special Counsel Robert Mueller has been investigating a period of time last summer when President Trump seemed determined to drive Attorney General Jeff Sessions from his job, according to people familiar with the matter, who said that a key area of interest for the inquiry is whether those efforts were part of a months-long pattern of attempted obstruction of justice. In recent months, Mueller's team has questioned witnesses in detail about Trump's private comments and state of mind in late July and early August of last year. Doesn't that seem really, really long ago?
Yeah.
Around the time he issued a series of tweets belittling his, quote, beleaguered attorney general. These people, according to these sources, the thrust of the questions was to determine whether the president's goal was to oust Sessions in order to pick a replacement who would exercise control over the investigation into possible coordination between Russia and Trump associates during the 2016 election. And yesterday, and this kind of happened, broke while we were on
we
the
were
air,
between,
that the president started to go after Sessions yet again.
Only Trump could make Sessions a sympathetic figure for those of us
who
could not stand the notion of him being the attorney general.
Sure. The thing is, his base really likes him, and this is a major break. I mean, yesterday, I really think this was a key story yesterday, because Sessions, despite all that Trump has done to denigrate him and embarrass him and attack him, he has taken it silently. And this is a fundamental break. And what he said basically out loud is, I'll not break the law for you, Mr. President. I refuse to break the law on your behalf.
As long as I am the Attorney General, I will continue to discharge my duties with integrity and honor. And this department will continue to do its work in a fair and impartial manner according to the law and Constitution.
Mm-hmm. You see, Trump does not understand that he believes Sessions should be his lawyer.
His attorney working for him,
doing what he says, when, as Sessions pointed out so eloquently, that's not the Constitution and that's not what the law says.
Can I also, and I know I'm picking the obvious scab here, but it's just, so in the tweet yesterday, why is Attorney General Jeff Sessions asking the Inspector General to investigate potentially massive FISA abuse? Why not use the Justice Department lawyers? Disgraceful. The same Justice Department lawyers that you have been deriding and debilitating over the last 7-8 months. I mean, that's, I just don't even understand where that is supposed to make sense.
It doesn't need to make sense.
Right, but
people have accepted that.
The fact is, the Justice Department lawyers, whose job it is to look at the internal workings of the Justice Department, is the Inspector General's office. The lawyers in the Inspector General's office. So Sessions did what Trump chastised him for not doing.
You know, not to conflate the two issues, but if you watch that gun thing yesterday at the cabinet room.
Oh, God.
And it was interesting on a number of levels, and if you'd like, we can get into it. But Trump, among the things that Trump said yesterday was, we're going to get the guns before it goes to court.
No due process.
And mm-hmm. that is a window into the way he views so many other areas of the law versus what he wants to do. I just thought it was, I hope Mueller was listening. I'm sure he'll get a tape.
It was an insight into sort of dictatorial thinking, or I don't know if Trump took a class in how tribal culture works, but pretty much that's what I see. It was like, you know, if you have the right bloodline, or if your family, or if you belong to the Trump empire, you must be elevated into a position. And I mean, it's just what you see. I could almost use the Trump administration in my in one of my Middle East politics classes to teach students how tribal culture works. You know,
when you think of it, the Second Amendment devotees prior to Trump were fearful that people like Obama were trying to take their guns away. And Obama never said anything of the sort. Trump essentially just said that yesterday.
Right. That is enormous irony. And he's blaming Obama for not having been able
right.
to achieve
Well, you
any
know, that just drives me nuts.
Guns.
I mean, let's just say for the sake of argument that any and all of what he blames Obama for having not done or Bush for having not done, whatever they didn't do, that's in the past. We don't care about that now. Right now, we've got a situation or situations that we need to move forward on. Don't tell me that the other guy didn't do it and then without saying, the other guy didn't do it and here's what we're going to do. You don't hear the other half.
You know, that was theater.
What's that, yesterday?
Yesterday's quote-unquote gun summit was real. You know, it was Trump reality TV. And everyone knows that, you know, what was said there is not actually going to be what happens. It was interesting what was said there. It certainly exposed the fact that he doesn't understand the issue. The problem is, well, the law. Well, precedent, what's happened in the past in the Congress, who stands where on the issue. But in the meantime, while everybody was watching television, out in the real world, you know, the Trump administration, Pruitt at EPA is dissolving the office that tests effects of chemicals exposure on children and adults. Over at HUD, they're spending $31,000 on a table, $158,000 to renovate the secretary's office while they're cutting funding for housing. Over at the Department of Agriculture, they're moving ahead on the plan to cut SNAP funding, you know, food for and have it be boxed processed food. So while, you know, while the reality TV show is going on and we're all watching television, you know, out there around the administration, stuff is happening that's really affecting people's lives. And the kids are going back to school. And in Florida, what was 68 million, whatever is millions of dollars they approved to put guns in the schools. When
so
they
are you suggesting
they don't even have funding for supplies in the schools?
Are you suggesting we shouldn't have watched that business?
No. I how could you not watch it? It's like a car yeah. wreck.
But it's it is important to know that every single time anything comes up, there's another big story that comes up that's a distraction. In the previous administrations, any administration for that matter, if any single one of these stories developed, we'd be obsessed with it and would be getting all the attention. But we're just moving on. I mean, we just moved from Hope Hicks, which is an extraordinary story, to talk about the reality TV show that was on yesterday that portrayed itself as a gun summit. And meanwhile, there's a complete realignment of the federal government and regulations. Banks are not being watched. I mean, this continues in every single area, Teresa.
And today, you know, they're going to have possible
tariffs
on aluminum
right.
that, mm-hmm. by all accounts, I don't understand this. I leave it to the other folks who do. But that could really alter our economy. You may
it
have
will,
a better
It will have
this.
A negative impact on the domestic economy in the long run, because everything, whenever you put tariffs on an import like that, the costs for consumers go up. And all these other companies that will be using steel and aluminum products are passing on the cost to the consumer, and wages aren't going up.
Let's pause there, take a break. We'll be back. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Mike Spain, Vera Carias-Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Teresa Bourgeois make up the panel. I'm Joe Donahue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It's very nice to have you with us. And let's move on to some other topics. And I guess really not move on, because I'd like to address the gun summit a little bit more. But we were talking about this, and Teresa, you were part of the conversation yesterday. I mean, we didn't think anything major was going to come. We didn't expect. You could see everyone being shocked by what the president said in regards to in regards to guns. But is it now going to be that in 24 hours or within the next 24 to 48 hour news cycle, the president's going to tell us about how the press has misreported it and
probably
and we have to take.
Right. I think, you know, the analysis wasn't, there's no question whether or not Sarah Huckabee Sanders will, if she will walk it back, it's a question of how she will walk it back. And then Paul Ryan.
The president didn't say that exactly.
You know, that's why
the president didn't say what you heard him say. No, but what I was trying to think about this, if you're those young people down in Parkland, you know, who are so passionate about this.
Who, by the way, I want to vote for.
Who I want to vote for. Or I saw that there were more than this Moms Demand Action. There were more than 200 people at a meeting in Boulder, Colorado, two nights ago. They were expecting about 20 or 30. And this is happening all over the country. Yeah. So if you're those people and you witness this, you know, then you get the sense of maybe something will happen. But we know it won't. What does that do?
See, I disagree. I agree with you that there was a reality TV element to that whole production. But there was a lot of substance in that thing. And whether or not if Trump walks it back, well, we've got yet another example of this guy who can't make up his mind, or he'll say whatever the last person in the room says. It's another part of his resume. If he doesn't walk it back, it was a major event in terms of the positions that he was staking out for himself, the corner in which he was painting fellow Republicans at that meeting. I mean, Senator Feinstein, the Democrat, could barely control her glee at what she was hearing. So I think there was a lot of substance. We don't know whether that substance is going to evaporate at the next press briefing. But if it does, it doesn't mean that what they said yesterday was unimportant, because it will have been a policy shift. You know, I thought that Trump must have been very happy with the way it was going. Because if you remember the beginning of the meeting, he says, we're going to go around the room and we'll keep the media in here for a while. And then I was waiting at any point in that media for somebody, if one of his aides, to say, OK, media may leave.
Hope Hicks wasn't there.
Hope Hicks was busy writing her resignation.
Yeah.
So they ran the entire meeting. And I, you know, it certainly came across like a reality show, but the stakes were a lot greater than when they were kicking somebody off of Omarosa's
show. Different too, though, than DACA. A lot of stories compare this to DACA, where he promised Chuck Schumer that they would get an agreement on DACA, and then he walked it back right away because Stephen Miller, one of his
he said, bring me a bill and I'll sign it.
But what happened yesterday was out in the public. It was in front of the cameras, and it is, I know they will. But it is going to be difficult. And even Breitbart, you know, the other side, you know, you're looking at the positive kind of reaction of the DiFis, the Dianne Feinsteins, et cetera, to what he was saying. And Chris Murphy DiFi from Connecticut.
That's a great one.
I like that. I like DiFi.
That's a California thing. You know?
She was masterful yesterday.
Yeah.
And then,
of course, Chuck Schumer, the New York senator and the Senate minority leader, they were all saying very positive things. But listen to what Breitbart said. He said that, that basically they had a headline that said, Trump, the gun grabber.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they're really attacking him. And this is Bannon, the guy it is showing that there's a lot going on and the war is not over.
And I just wanted to mention that the National Rifle Association took Trump's comments very seriously, and they kicked lobbying into high gear this morning
terms buying
of
ads.
Buying ads and spent meetings and consultations, and so they're going for a frontal counter assault here.
So we talk a lot on this program, and we say this a lot, which is, okay, the base. What does this say to the base? How does this, because this seems to be anti-base.
Partly, though, but I think it upholds his image of standing up to tradition and looking at it in the face and ignoring it and trying to be unilateral about things. And I think as much as that has repulsed Democrats and people who are left of center, it has emboldened the base. They like the way that he just does things completely contrary to the way things ought to be, like the Constitution, law, etc. And he looks that way when he looks at the NRA, and he says, you shouldn't be scared of the NRA. I'm not scared of the NRA. I don't know how long it'll last, but I think even if you don't agree with them, if you're somebody who...
I could walk into an NRA meeting with my bare hands and...
Yes. That's right.
He also said at one point that his popularity is not important to him.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Right. So, but the other interesting thing I would say is I believe that Trump has somehow figured out that young people are very serious about pushing back against this access to guns. Somehow... somebody
could it be
whispered,
he has empathy now? I mean,
I don't
he
think the man has empathy. Yeah. He needs cards to read the right questions on empathy and to use the right wording. But I think he does watch media obsessively, and so I think he has clicked through the stations and heard some young people speak.
He knows which
way
the wind is blowing.
So he believes there's a shift in the cultural attitude, possibly. And that he has picked up on, and possibly the NRA is very concerned about that shift, I believe.
Well, and I heard about, I've heard in the discussions from political pundits, yes, certainly that shift, but also the very realistic political issue of the state of Florida, right? Of what that means,
right? And
not to mention the retailers.
That's
Walmart
exactly
and Walmart and Dick's.
I think probably what's driving the NRA is, and then Kroger this morning. I think that looking at who's investing in these gun companies, you know, there's a whole effort to look at, you know, the financial side of these companies, who's investing, and are my investments investing in high powered weapons? If so, get my money out of there. Kroger.
What do they do? Aren't they a supermarket chain?
Yeah, but apparently they also sell guns.
Is that
they
right?
Announced today that they're not going to.
They pick up a dozen eggs and a couple of rifles.
Sour cream and a Glock.
But I do think that there, you know, a lot of the stuff that he said showed how common sense it was to make some of these changes. You know, if you listen just parts of what he said, I think that the Democrats were masterful by going in there talking about only he can do this and you know, playing to his ego and getting him to say some of the stuff. I think that they were masterful.
They
I
were swallowing their pride, weren't they?
They did. They did.
They had to have been surprised by what they heard. I mean, Chris Murphy.
They baited him and he took the bait.
Well, you know, Chris Murphy would not have rolled over, but I think he saw that he read the room and he read what he heard early in the meetings, and then he did what you said.
But ironically, he went after he went after the Republicans for not standing up to the NRA, but he went out after Pat Toomey, who's mm-hmm. the one Republican who does stand up to the IRA.
NRA.
IRA.
That's another issue.
That's a whole other issue that's going on in the world right now.
Well, you mentioned one Murphy and it screws everything up.
I wish they would stop. I wish they would stop using my initials.
I love the description in the New York Times story. Giddy Democrats and stone-faced Republicans.
Well, Dianne Feinstein looked giddy.
I mean,
she did look giddy.
She was just fantastic.
Yeah, she was a schoolgirl. Just shocked. Oh, yeah. Best news she's had all week.
Disbelief, perhaps.
Yeah, she's had a bad week after the Democrats in California would not support Dianne Feinstein's candidacy or nomination for another term.
You know, with a different president and a different set of history that we've already seen of him in office, we could say that Trump was just opening an art of a deal situation where he really took the extreme anti-NRA position and will eventually expect it to come back more towards the middle.
But the problem is he was on all sides of the issue.
Yes.
And he kept talking about this as if it's a state's issue, mm-hmm. as if you could pass the national legislation, yet states could do a state's rights. And in reality, right now, where this is going to change is at the state and county and local level, because you're not going to get anything through Paul Ryan, I don't think. But I think the political pressure really needs to be financial pressure and state and local. Yeah.
By the way, conspicuous by his actions, you were talking about the political ramifications in Florida. Senator Nelson was not invited to this meeting yesterday, and he is purported to be planning a run for governor against Scott. And there is a theory that Trump purposely did not invite Nelson so as not to give him the platform that might help him later on in a gubernatorial race.
Yeah, and one side issue here is the NRA has been pushing conceal and carry, where basically you could come in to any state and they'd have to honor the other state's granting
right,
you of a license.
Law.
Reciprocity
yeah.
law. Mm-hmm. And that looks like that's dead in the on
you
arrival.
You made that clear
thankfully.
To Senator Zinn.
That was a dangerous, dangerous.
Yes,
that is
was.
A dangerous, dangerous.
Absolutely. And that was interesting to me how hard he was hitting against that. So he heard something that really has gotten him focused that that's not a good thing. Of course, now that's the Republicans want to pair that with bump stocks mm-hmm. and say they've done something because
goodness.
They want to use bump stocks to carry that over the threshold. But mm-hmm.
but he says he can do bump stocks by himself.
Except for if he does that, by all accounts, then there'll be lawsuits immediately. It'll be tied up in the courts for years because that's
that scares
what
him.
The NRA wants him to do it administratively because they can then stop it if they do it legislatively.
Well, they don't want to put congressmen all on right. the spot either.
We have to take a break. I don't want to get Ray impatient.
Don't upset Ray.
No. Ray, you all right, Ray?
I told him it was all right, Ray.
Okay. We got a thumbs up. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot more to talk about, many other topics, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Mike Spain is here, Vera Carius-Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Teresa Bourgeois. Alan is off today and tomorrow, and we'll be back on Monday. But we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to some letters in a little bit. But before we do that, let us talk about the story that is in the New York Times today. This is about Kushner's family business received loans after White House meetings. This is really, I think, by all accounts, an explosive story. I don't know if it's overly surprising, but it is it is an explosive story. Apollo, the private equity firm, and Citigroup made large loans last year to the family real estate business of Jared Kushner, President Trump's senior advisors. And while that, on the face of it, may not seem all that unusual, what is unusual is it directly followed meetings that they had with Jared Kushner at the White House. They paid regular visits to this private equity billionaire, paid regular visits to the White House. Joshua Harris is his name, a founder of Apollo Global Management, advising the Trump administration on infrastructure policy. During that period, he met on multiple occasions with Jared Kushner, of course, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor. And among other things, the two men discussed a possible White House job for Mr. Harris. Well, that job never materialized, but Apollo did lend $184 million to Mr. Kushner's family real estate firm, Kushner Companies. The loan was to refinance the mortgage on a Chicago skyscraper. Even by the standards of Apollo, one of the world's largest private equity firms, the previously unreported transaction with the Kushners was a big deal. It was triple the size of the average property loan made by Apollo's real estate lending arm, Security, according to securities filings. The one thing I wanted to, there was one other part of this that I wanted to, well, I'll find it in a second. There was something about what Jared Kushner said about this, and it's really interesting because ultimately, this is from the spokesman of Mr. Kushner's lawyer, that any information or any document concerning any business dealing, it was basically that this was all in an attempt to doing the work of the White House. And while there is a separation between the business, what he was doing, all goes together because it's the good of the economy. Did you get that? Wasn't that the sense?
Yeah, that's stunning. Yeah, I wonder what you thought of this. You were up for the Media Project taping today. This is an example of the extraordinary investigative journalism that's going on now from the New York
Times. It's unlike anything that I've seen. I lived through Watergate, but I wasn't as tuned in to that element of it. It's incredible. And, we talk about the cable news programs that people are flocking to. Almost every night at 8 o'clock when CNN comes on or MSNBC comes on, they're talking about a new story that either the Times or the Washington Post has just broken.
And with the reporters.
And that's so nice to see. They're not television people. These are the reporters.
This is Maggie Haberman.
Incredible work.
My nephew is a editor at the New York Times, and I was asking about this recently, about how often you see these New York Times people on the air, and most of them don't get paid for it. As I suspected, he said, you know, New York Times is very pleased to have the exposure to get to get them on the air.
Yeah. And it is truly astounding what's going on when you think about the position that Kushner is in, the foreign policy deals he apparently wants to cut, and then he mixes in private financial business loans. I mean, it is truly astounding when you think about Article 1, Section 9, the emolument clause, the foreign emolument clause of the Constitution, and the question of what the founding, what the founders discussed was foreign meddling and foreign influence. And here we have achieved the highest levels of that, in essence.
And this is the guy that President Trump portrayed as the next Henry Kissinger. He tried to set this 37-year-old real estate kid up as a foreign negotiator that would really supersede what the Secretary of State does. And he can now, because of his lowered security clearance, can't even hear the full report of what's going on. It compromises him enormously. And there's a lot of speculation. He may just, Kushner may just go back to New York, and then Trump will have nobody around him.
Well, one can only hope, because Kushner, in a position of foreign policy, of the highest levels of foreign policy advising, it's really appalling. The guy has no idea about what all these agendas are in the various countries. He's just so arrogant. The hubris in that office
is
astounding.
This is the paragraph I was trying to find. Kushner resigned as chief executive of Kushner Companies when he joined the White House last January, and he sold a small portion of his stake in the company to a trust controlled by his mother. But he retained the vast majority of his interest in Kushner Companies. His real estate holdings and other investments are worth as much as $761 million, according to government ethics filings. They're likely worth much more because the estimate has his firm's debt subtracted from the value of his holdings. The company has done at least $7 billion of deals in the past decade. And this is anecdotal, but I think true. I think we could all agree that obviously it's worth a little bit more when you're sitting in the White House, right?
One would think, because, I mean, you remember when it was Kushner's sister who was in China trying to cut a deal for the Kushner family and using sort of an on-screen reference to her brother in the White House and making all these sort of connections for the Chinese. And obviously then the Chinese were talking about how he might be vulnerable to, you know, because of his financial situation. I mean, it's truly shocking the access that some of the foreign governments have, because Kushner did not disclose what kind of meetings he had with whom and for how long and what was. He was not even informing the State Department.
He was not truthful.
He was not truthful. He was not disclosing the kinds of agendas that were discussed.
That's a question I wanted to throw Teresa's way, which is a double question, really. One is how in the name of God is this legal? But also, because even the ethics people are saying, well, you know, there's some this could raise some concerns. I'm like, okay. But the other thing, too, is this idea that the Trump administration no longer publicly discloses logs of visitors to the White House, you know, the people's house.
Right. And that was not surprising, but they say with transparency. I think the way it's not necessarily legal, but can they catch them on it? Because, it 1 + 1 = 2, but you have to prove it, right? To prove one resulted in the other, I think is challenging. But let's remember that at the same time this is happening, you have Donald Trump Jr. in India, focusing on major deals and a new Trump Tower there. You have just down the street at the post office all of these countries and organizations holding events at the Trump Hotel. You have what's going on at Mar-a-Lago. So there's a lot of apparent enriching oneself all over the place. This is so blatant. But also there's things in the Time story. I was interested toward the end. They talk about shortly after Krishna, I'm reading this, company received a loan from Apollo. The private equity firm emerged as a beneficiary of a tax package, tax cut in the package. Back down from earlier pledge to close a loophole that permits private equity managers to pay taxes on the bulk of their income rates at rates that are roughly half of ordinary income tax. So there's, you know, tax favoritism. What's the price tag of not closing that loophole? And what could be done with that money? That's what I want. You know, what is the price tag of that? And so at a time when we have incredible deficits and growing deficits, this is a another loophole that goes to the top 1%. What do we do about it?
I mean, what I've started to realize is that this administration wakes up in the morning, members of this administration wake up in the morning, and they think first about how they can enrich themselves, and then secondarily they consider how they can sort of make it look good to the rest of the country.
Well, you know, I was gonna raise a point that's similar to that. In that, I remember many years ago when I was still writing editorials, and I can't remember what prompted it, but I remember writing something to the effect of, you know, we ought to elect a business person to this job because a business person has the experience and knows how to the experience of running a large entity and knows how to delegate and knows business, et cetera, et cetera. And so now we have finally done so, but the election of Trump. And the question I have, and it's, you know, all we can do now is speculate, but does this put to rest why we should not be electing a business person? Because look at what the entanglements that are happening now. Or is it just that we had the misfortune of electing an outlier who by...
I'd like to think the latter. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of business people who have brought a lot to government and they can bring their expertise, but they also brought ethics and they brought honesty, and that was lacking this mm-hmm. time.
And also an understanding of the world. But the core is having a basic belief in the Constitution and the rule of law and ethics and following those guidelines.
But I wonder whether because Trump seems to do so much by the seat of his pants, which may not be the case. I wonder whether after the election, the family gathered for Thanksgiving at Mar-a-Lago and mapped out all of these. You know, they talk about the family, this being a criminal family enterprise. I won't state that yet. I'll let Mueller do that. But you've got Don Jr., you're going to go to India and do this, and Jared, you're going to get these loans, and this, and you think they actually planned all of this out? Do you think they came into office?
I don't think any of this is planned.
Well, that's right. They're flying by the seat of their pants. They didn't expect to win.
I think they're just doing business. This is the way they've always done business.
Exactly.
It's transactional.
The rules don't matter.
It's just that now they're inside of government, and you shouldn't be doing that outside of government. But look at all the stuff with Manafort. Look at what they did for years and never got caught. You know, that's going on all the time.
This is standard operating procedure for the Trump family. This is always how they do business. They've always done it that way. They've always messed with people. They have not paid their employees. They have screwed over people. And this is what they're doing to the entire country now. This is standard for the Trumps.
In the meantime.
Yes.
You know, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, but again, I'll go back to my boring self. In the meantime, 20 Republican governors have filed a suit against the Obamacare that's probably going to destroy it. In the meantime, over at the Department of Health and Human Services, they're moving ahead with the so-called short-term, you know, health insurance programs, which are called junk insurance, that are going to really undermine the insurance
programs.
Right,
pulls the rug out from under Obamacare. It's mm-hmm. it's being dismantled, even though Congress elected not to dismantle it.
You know, pick the agency. If you go over to the Department of the Interior, you have Scott Pruitt and, giving leases at very historically low.
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill. You know, the Energy Department letting people drill offshore. You just go agency to agency, and you see not only are they, you know, like Wilbur Ross at Commerce Department issues about his conflicts of interest, and certainly at HUD, but not only are they enriching themselves, but the policies that they're implementing are just.
But if Mike Pence was deficit. The president, he'd probably be doing the same stuff.
Oh, don't even get me going.
Right.
About
so my
Mike
point
Pence.
Is, I don't know that Mike.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say
it would be a different problem. With Mike
all of those issues that you raise are clearly important issues, and the impact of the Trump presidency in changing these issues is going to be felt by us years after Trump is out of office. But as important as those are, I believe the major negative that Trump has created in this country is denigrating the office of the presidency, denigrating the stature of this country around the world.
I agree with
and,
that.
And I don't know how – I don't know if it's going to take a generation or more for that to turn around, or if we elect the next president who is entirely different, you know, if we elect another Obama or another
right.
progressive, that yeah. they will turn it back the way it should have been or the way it has been.
I don't disagree, but the day-to-day effect on people's lives – premiums are going up.
Without question.
Coverage is going down, you know.
Yeah.
But my point is not that all of that is not happening. It's clearly happening, and it's important. But that might happen without a Trump. The Trump impact goes beyond policy.
There is the, as I alluded to at the beginning of the show, Mike Pence, since we brought up his name, was speaking to the Susan B. Anthony List and Life Institute. Said, I know in my heart of hearts that this will be the generation that restores life in America. I truly do believe if all of us do all that we can, that we will once again in our time restore the sanctity of life to the center of American law. But we have to do the work.
Well, he could still be president before the next election. Probably not. But
you never know.
But I think if you're concerned about life, you have to be concerned about life not just from conception to birth. You have to be concerned about life after birth.
Correct.
And if you look again, you know, look at what's in their budget. Look at the cuts in programs for pre-K or prenatal or 0 to 3 or
nutrition.
Look at cuts in nutrition programs. Look at, you know, again in Florida, they're going to put $67 million into putting guns in the schools, yet the teachers say we don't, you know, we have to buy our own paper. We ran out of paper to print copies of tests. You know, let's focus on the full life of a healthy child and take care of sick children and so on and so forth. Let's not decimate hospitals and, you know.
In essence, I think American voters have to start thinking about what they prioritize. Do they buy these lines? Do they buy into performance art? Or will they step up and say, you know, from the local level to all the way to the highest office in this country, will people step up and say, enough is enough? We care more about our children's education and the safety of our children, or we care more about talk on, you know, improving the economy, making America great again, or these slogans that are used.
I'd like to hear some people start saying that the First Amendment is as, if not more, sacrosanct as the Second Amendment.
Well, I'd like to say that we should, as a country, agree that schools should be gun-free zones.
Yeah, no doubt.
This notion that the response to Parkland and all these shootings is to add more guns to the mix, I mean, that's basically what...
Insane when you think about every other highly developed liberal democracy does not deal with this issue. I mean, everybody has figured out how to get guns out of the country and out of the hands of criminals. And
we have 10 seconds, but let me just bring this back to what we started with, which was your cab driver in Guatemala.
Yes.
Right?
He was saying, finally, you got a guy like we are used to. This is just crazy.
Maybe we're not.
I don't think Guatemala is one of those liberal democracies you were talking
about.
No, but
I mean, they have elections.
But maybe we aren't anymore either.
But we are not anymore either because they're sort of seeing some of the parallels. And I was thinking, wow, that's pretty scary when they're looking at us like a banana republic. Here we are.
We're out of time, but... 5 seconds.
Well, as they said last night, can we stay within the guardrails of our democracy? Can we get out of this having stayed within the guardrails of what our democracy
is? Time's up. Thank you all. We'll be back right after this.